This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's NBA All-Star Weekend in Las Vegas, a venue not entirely unfamiliar with excess and hoopla. Two-time Most Valuable Player Steve Nash and Allen Iverson lead the list of worthies who will not be playing, but the game and the slam dunk contest and a lot of parties will go on nevertheless. Joining me now to talk about the occasion is Marty Burns, who is a senior writer for CNNSI.com. Marty, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Las Vegas is a busy place 365 days a year, or so I'm told, but now that the NBA's coaches, owners, players, entourages, and other hangers-on have descended on the city, I'm almost afraid to ask what it looks like. How has the city handled hosting its first major sporting event since opening night of the late and not particularly lamented XFL?
Yeah, so far so good. I think they're going to set a record for stretch limousines here in the city, and that says something for Las Vegas.
Yeah, I'll say. Las Vegas has been trying to lure a major pro sports team to the desert for years now. The only problem is the metro area is home to about 2 million gamblers. Do you think that Commissioner David Stern will eventually be able to handle a team in such close proximity to Vegas sportsbooks?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable almost at this point. There seems to be a lot of momentum building for putting a professional team here in Vegas. Gambling is, a concern, and it is for all sports leagues. The NBA in particular has been very opposed to gambling, but the Nevada casinos agreed to take this NBA All-Star game off the books for this day. And if they could do something like that, come to an agreement where they would not put the NBA on the books, most people seem to think that would be the last hurdle left for the NBA to clear before they would bring a team here to Vegas.
Former center John Amici's admission that he is gay in his recently published book has sparked a good deal of controversy, and former All-Star guard Tim Hardaway brought more furor to the issue when he declared that he hated gay people on a national radio program. Hardaway was subsequently disinvited from this weekend's All-Star activities by the league. Are people in Vegas talking about this at all?
Oh, yeah. It's a big topic around the league. Obviously, the league acted very swiftly with that punishment, and on Tim Hardaway, he will not be representing the league at all. I think he had some events here planned that he's been replaced. And it's just a very interesting topic. The NBA has always been a league at the forefront of diversity and acceptance and that kind of thing, and I think they've made a big statement with this issue. And, we'll see how it all plays out. But if nothing else, it's brought a lot of discussion about the issue.
Do you agree with Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, who has said that the first openly gay current NBA player will be a hero?
Well, that's funny. Yes and no. I think if it were a player were a star player, I think this would be a much bigger story. The fact John Amici really was a fringe player in the NBA has kind of taken some of the impact away. But when a star player comes out, and I think in today's world, we are willing to, accept people, and I think the reaction of the NBA, for instance, shows that, the league is certainly going to support anybody, and I just think that, Cuban's probably right, although some of the reaction to the story has been way off. I mean, Charles Barkley came out and said that he thought that no player would be under any stress in the locker room, that the players in the locker room would tolerate it, and yet I think we heard from Tim Hardaway that that's not necessarily the case.
The slam dunk competition is back for another year, although some people wish that it weren't. What's the problem with watching great athletes fly around with a basketball in their hands?
Yeah, well, the only problem is that almost every dunk, it seems, has been done before. We've now seen everything. They had to do away with the slam dunk contest a few years ago just for that reason. And the other big factor is that the star players stopped doing it. And I think the reason for that mainly is that there's really very little incentive for a Kobe Bryant or a LeBron James to participate in these events anymore because they're already making so much money outside, they don't need the prize money, and all they can do really is embarrass themselves at this point.
No one will be happier to start the season second half than the Dallas Mavericks. The Mavs own a 9-game winning streak and the league's best record, and with the Suns struggling with injuries, what do you think? Is Dallas the clear favorite in the Western Conference?
I think right now Dallas and Phoenix have established themselves as clearly the top two teams in the league. And Dallas, of course, made it to the finals last year and blew a 2-0 lead. So they're very motivated to get back and get it right this time. And they have great balance. The Suns, of course, led by Steve Nash, highest scoring team in the league, very exciting to watch. And it's kind of an interesting question because in basketball in general, and especially the NBA, defense is usually determine who wins the championship. You have to have a good defense to win, and Phoenix really does not have a great defense, but they try to outscore everybody. And so it's going to be very fun to watch down the remainder of the season in the playoffs whether Phoenix's style can prevail.
A favorite pastime for NBA fans recently has been making fun of the Eastern Conference, but that much-maligned conference may have a re-emerging power in the Detroit Pistons. They've been revived by formerly washed-up, now apparently wily veteran center Chris Webber. Can this team win a second title in 4 years?
Yeah, well, you said it. You know, Chris Webber was a former All-Star player, and I thought when he got picked up by the Pistons after being waived by the lowly Philadelphia 76ers, that it was a big stretch, kind of a reach for Detroit. But he has fit in very well. He's playing at center now instead of power forward. And Detroit has Rasheed Wallace at power forward. He's able to cover for a lot of Weber's weaknesses. So it's really worked out very well. And so they would probably be the favorites. But you do have to look out for the Miami Heat. They got Shaq back now after he missed a lot of this season with an injury. Shaq and Dwayne Wade, that's a great combination to start. So we'll see if they can make a run here in the second half of the season as well.
Marty Burns covers the NBA for CNNSI.com. Marty, thanks very much for joining us. And make sure you stay away from the $25 blackjack tables yourself, okay?
Yeah, I don't make enough money to spend much time there.
All right, thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Even before Hurricane Katrina swamped New Orleans and wrecked Tulane University's 2005-2006 men's basketball season, Dave Dickerson, then the Green Wave's first-year head coach, knew he had his work cut out for him. Tulane has struggled for about a decade and hasn't won a postseason game since it finished third in the NIT in 1996. Dickerson, a former University of Maryland star, now must help the Green Wave fight through adversity, a topic he knows well. Only a Game's Keith O'Brien has our story.
Tulane players scurry down the court at Fogelman Arena in New Orleans, running drills at the start of a recent practice. Off to the side, Dave Dickerson stands in green sweats, his arms folded, watching. At 6'6", he towers over some of his players. And even though he turns 40 next month, there doesn't appear to be 1 ounce of fat on his body.
Tell you what, Dave, you look young enough to be out here playing with these guys.
I am.
Dickerson doesn't crack a smile. He's not joking. But his job these days is coaching, not playing. And that's keeping him plenty busy. Since he was hired as Tulane's coach in April 2005, very little has gone right for the Green Wave.
For the last year and a half, what we've been trying to do is just survive.
First, the team was displaced by Hurricane Katrina, forced to play home games in Texas. Then its star point guard, Taylor Rochesti, was injured and transferred. Another point guard quit the team, too, and almost every recruit that Dickerson had identified for his 2006 class decided they'd rather not come to New Orleans.
So we identified 15 kids, and 13 of them turned us down after the storm. They wouldn't have anything to do with New Orleans or Tulane University simply because of the perception of what they saw on CNN or what they saw through the national news. And quite naturally, we didn't have a campus or we didn't have a city to show at that time. So we were stuck in College Station at Texas A&M. So we got rejected by a lot of kids and a lot of families.
Dickerson could have bailed out, too. There were rumors that he had coaching options elsewhere. But a quick look at his personal history shows he's not the sort to cut and run. He grew up poor in tiny Olar, South Carolina, the son of a truck driver and a woman who died young. Basketball was his ticket out. He went to Maryland, where he played with Len Bias. He was at the hospital the morning Bias died of a drug overdose, and there for all the questions that followed. And then, after graduation in 1989, he hit the road as an assistant coach for 15 years, including 9 on the bench with Gary Williams at Maryland.
The one thing that I've learned from Gary Williams is that he should say every year that no one from the outside will decide how good we will be during the year. No media, no conference office, no set of circumstances. It will be the players on the floor and the coaches on the floor. We're going to decide how good we are.
Last year, Dickerson asked his players to take the same approach. They responded by going 12-17 and surprising everyone by finishing in a tie for 6th in Conference USA. And Dickerson even managed to convince a few recruits to take a chance on Tulane.
Name is Kevin Sims from Jackson, Mississippi.
Sims, a 5'10" point guard, considered going to Mississippi State, Southern Miss, and the University of Alabama, Birmingham. But he was impressed by Dickerson, and even after the storm, opted to come to Tulane. Now as a freshman, he leads the Green Wave and assists, is the team's second leading scorer, and he's a big believer in Coach Dickerson's play hard mentality.
He preached that every day in practice and games. Play hard, play hard. If you play hard, you got a chance. So we got a chance to win. We play hard every time you step on the court. So we got a chance to win every game we play.
Even still, Tulane does get blown out from time to time. Just last weekend, number 8 ranked Memphis dismantled the Green Wave 95-51. But Tulane is hanging around in a lot of games. They're 12-11 overall, 5-6 in conference play, and Dickerson's players are not giving up on their goal. Kevin Sims says it's simple.
If we get to the postseason, that's one of the biggest things we're trying to do right now, get to the postseason. If we can do that, showing big improvement in the program.
NIT, NCAA?
NIT, NCAA. We take what we can get.
Dickerson believes Tulane's goal of making the postseason is not too far-fetched.
We had a chance to end up fourth in the conference last year, and we lost two games that really hurt us. If we win those two games, we're fourth in this conference with a chance to go to the NIT. So our guys know how close it is. They're smart enough to understand the March Madness. You know what? If any team in the country deserved to play in the postseason, it's Tulane basketball and the guys that I'm coaching, because they epitomize what college athletics is all about and what they've gone through and where they are now. They deserve it, but we have to earn that also.
Get hot at the right time, you can make the postseason, steal a few games, maybe shock the world. That's why Dickerson pushes his players up and down the court, asks them to dig down deep, scrap and fight. It's almost March after all, the season of the Cinderella story. And Tulane's players are asking themselves a simple question. Why can't it be us? For Only a Game, I'm Keith O'Brien in New Orleans.
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, success comes to the University of Oklahoma women's basketball team later rather than sooner. But first, the Iowa State High School Wrestling Tournament begins Wednesday in Des Moines. For those unfamiliar with the passion Iowans bring to wrestling, start with Indiana basketball and Texas football as points of reference. Picture a high school senior settling into his wrestler's stance while an auditorium full of fans anticipates the young man's fourth state championship. Picture an enraged woman roaring at her 5-year-old son because all he wants to do out there on the middle of the mat is quit. Imagine a father whose sense of self-worth depends pretty much entirely on whether one of his sons can roll another boy onto his back and pin his shoulders to a mat. These are all images from 4 Days to Glory, subtitled Wrestling with the Soul of the American Heartland by Mark Creedler. Mr. Creedler joins me now from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. Mr. Creedler, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you, Bill, so much. Nice to be here.
Let's start with that phrase, the American Heartland, from the subtitle, because I think it's a little bit misleading. Isn't this really a book about the wrestling culture of one state?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I think the Heartland sort of refers to the fact that Iowa sits pretty squarely in the middle of everything in the United States. It's sort of, before I arrived there, in fact, it was for me what it is for a lot of Americans, which is the ultimate flyover. And however, and it's certainly true that wrestling as a sport and as a culture is celebrated up and down the Middle West and the Heartland. With that said, Iowa was really the only place to go for this particular story. It's the cradle of the sport, and it's the one place where I think, Bill, the sport is held sacred, and that's what drew me to it initially.
Iowa has made heroes of its wrestlers at various levels. Olympic champion Dan Gable is perhaps the most dramatic example. To what extent do the young wrestlers about whom you write aspire to be like Gable?
It's interesting. Gable is such a legend, which is an odd term to apply to someone still alive. But he casts such a shadow over what happens in Iowa that there is this sense that no one can ever be him. And yet that's where the bar is set. I think these guys have it in their minds, certainly the characters that we encounter in this book have it in their minds, I think, that they might someday be regarded as capable of shaking Gable's hand. Let's put it that way. that's the level. And again, you're talking about a very inward-looking sport. It's not a sport that's celebrated much anywhere else. It's held very close to the hearts of Iowans in particular because it's what they do. And so for a wrestler to even receive a favorable word from Gable is, you know, sort of akin to being touched with holy water.
Of that constant struggle that many wrestlers face to lose weight and stay at their fighting weight, you write, "The weights in wrestling are an elaborate shell game with human consequences." Tell me a little more about what the game is and what the consequences can be.
Well, here's the thing, and it's something that makes this sport different, certainly than the sports that I normally write about. Wrestling is a sport in which your greatest advantage lies in your ability to essentially starve yourself down or work out yourself, exercise yourself down to a weight that is substantially below what your frame would normally carry. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, all of the medical evidence, all of the wrestling evidence shows that you're much better off losing 10 pounds. If you naturally weigh 167 pounds, you're much better off trying to diet and exercise your way down to 152 and take on wrestlers in that weight class than you are to wrestle somewhere near your own normal body weight, because what happens is you retain most of your musculature as you go down to the lower weight. You're a bigger physical specimen, but there is definitely a long-term effect on a kid trying to yo-yo his way through 8 or 9 or 11 or 12 pounds every single week. Mm. But that's what the evidence shows. I mean, there is every incentive for a truly competitive wrestler to try and get his weight down and go down to that lower class.
It sounds a little bit like the male equivalent of what gymnasts and figure skaters who are women and girls sometimes go through.
Yeah, and it's a very separating thing. It makes, you know, the way that phenomenon is spun in the wrestling culture is very much the way that it was and has been spun for years in gymnastics and figure skating, which is, this is what makes you better. This is what makes our sport holy and sacred, is that the other sports don't have to do this. They don't suffer for their sport the way we suffer for our sport, and we suffer alone, and it makes us better. That, you know, and that's exactly the rallying cry you would expect of a sport that's not widely celebrated.
During the wrestling season about which you write, Dan LeClaire is one of the boys who has a chance to win a fourth state championship. Jay Borschel is the other wrestler facing that opportunity. Four-time state champ is quite a distinction, but I'm not sure I've ever read about any athletes who were so grim about what they were trying to accomplish. When they succeeded, were they happy or were they finally just relieved?
I read into their emotion nothing so much as relief. It was a sense, and I think it's partly because of the time that I met up with these guys. The pressures had already intensified. They were already three-time state champions. In Iowa, in this sport, to become a four-time individual champ is to join a very, very short list, which is to say, in Iowa, it is to become immortal. And so for both of these guys, at the point at which we take up their story, they've won three championships already. They've had many years of success and, I would assume, happiness. But when I see them, they are so engaged in this attempt that they have no room for any other overt emotion. All emotion is funneled into this effort. Mm. It takes all of their concentration and it takes all of their focus. And I should say, on top of that, wrestlers are just stoics. I mean, there's really, you know, not a lot of expressive wrestlers out there. They're a stoic bunch. You know, it's such an inward-directed sport. They tend to focus on this small, select group of people who they even think could possibly understand what they go through. But I really felt for both of these kids that their overriding sensation was a sense that the pressure was removed immediately upon the conclusions of their matches.
stoicism may be apparent, as you're suggesting, but at the Veterans Memorial Auditorium in Des Moines, where the state championship tournament was held, you witnessed what seemed to me at least to be a very strange phenomenon. Wrestlers who lost frequently sprinted off the mat and disappeared down the stairs into the basement of the building before the other wrestler, the winning wrestler, had even stood up sometimes. Why was that?
There is, I think, an unspoken sort of code within the sport that suggests, again, you suffer alone. And for the losing wrestler, there is the only requirement at the end of that match is that you stand long enough to shake the hand of the winner. Now, that is the most ceremonial thing you've ever seen. It is so pro forma that these are two guys who can't wait to leave each other, generally speaking. And so what has developed over this time, especially on a huge stage, and remember these guys generally wrestle in tiny gyms in front of a crowd of how soon can you get here? And suddenly they're in front of, you know, 11,000 people, 12,000 people. If that moment of great upset occurs, let's say, favored wrestler losing, he will not process his emotions in front of this crowd. He will bolt downstairs, down to the basement, and he will suffer alone because that's what the culture of the sport suggests he's supposed to do. And, you know, I've noticed, I happened to be at a college tournament just recently and noticed that many of the collegiate wrestlers do exactly the same. Get up off the mat, shake the hand quickly, and get out of sight. Mm-hmm. Whatever they process alone.
Mark Kreidler is the author of 4 Days to Glory, Wrestling with the Soul of the American Heartland, published by HarperCollins. He spoke with me from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
The women's basketball team at the University of Oklahoma is commanding its fair share of attention these days. The 14th-ranked Sooners are 19-4 and find themselves in a four-way tie atop the Big 12 conference standings. The team has come quite a long way since 1990, when the program was struggling so badly that it was dropped. Though it was reinstated 8 days later, it floundered for several more seasons until being rescued by an expectant high school coach and twin sisters. Greg Eklund reports.
Former athletics administrator Marita Hines vividly remembers the attendance at the University of Oklahoma women's basketball games during the early to mid-90s.
I would do an attendance count by standing up at the top of the arena and going, one, two, three. And you could really count the number of people in the stands, sometimes 60 to 100 people.
At the time, Hines worked in marketing and promotions. In July of 1995, she was promoted to Associate Athletic Director. Less than a year into her new position, Hines hired Norman High School's head basketball coach, Sherry Cole. Hines says that unusual choice was, in fact, an easy one after Cole's job interview.
She walked in, she was 8 months pregnant, and she walked in and handed each one of us a written plan. It didn't have actually a timeline, but it had a very detailed plan of how she could turn the program around. When she walked out of that door after the interview, we all leaned back in our chairs and said, I think I can go play for her right now, you know.
During the 1996-1997 season, the Sooners were victorious in one Big 12 contest and only 5 overall in 27 games. 3 seasons after that disastrous start, the Sooners won the Big 12 and made the NCAA Sweet 16. In 2002, the Sooners reached the national championship game against Connecticut. That caught the attention of the Paris sisters of Piedmont, California, daughters of former NFL defensive lineman Bubba Paris. On February 4th, more than 12,000 OU Hoops fans put their Super Bowl party plans on hold for the Sooners' home game against in-state rival Oklahoma State. Courtney Paris, a 6'4" sophomore sensation who, along with her 6'3" twin sister, Ashley, helped the Sooners sweep through the Big 12 season a year ago without a blemish, scored 41 points against the Oklahoma State Cowboys. She also had 19 rebounds to keep alive an incredible streak of 49 straight double-doubles. OSU coach Kurt Budke, after the game, said his Cowboys were trying to, using his words, keep Paris from scoring much more than 30 points.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, that's why people got to respect her as the best player in this country. She's the best player in this country. And I've been saying it since the first day I saw her, and nothing changed my mind tonight. I love her. She's a great luxury to have for a coach.
Courtney now boasts a string of 51 double-doubles. As Courtney explains, she and her sister like the idea of taking Sooner basketball to a new level.
It's just been cool to, one, be a part of something great and come in and see those 2002 trophies where they got to the Final Four, but also be a part of what helps us elevate even more. So it's just been a cool experience, and I love how old fans are still cheering us on and new people every day, you know, guys who you think would never watch women's basketball are like, oh, we saw the game, we're so excited. So I think it's really cool, not only for us, but for our sport.
Cole's message to prospects is the same as the one forwarded to the Paris sisters, who had never been to Oklahoma before their recruiting trip.
When you get kids from either coast who've never been necessarily to the Midwest, but particularly to the state of Oklahoma, the first thing you do is you tell them we have concrete, we have buildings, we have houses and running water and everything, because they tend to think the grapes of wrath, you know, there's just dirt blowing across the plains. And I think kids are always pleasantly surprised when they set foot on our campus.
Only two parts of Cole's original plan remains unfulfilled: the total self-sufficiency of the women's basketball program and a national championship. But with 8,000 season tickets sold this year, doubling last year's total, athletic director Joe Castiglione says self-sufficiency is not far off.
She's understood what it takes to market women's basketball in this market, which is a unique market. I'm not saying we're a kind of a market that has certain challenges that other markets don't possess, but everywhere has its own culture, and you have to make it work for the place in which the team is located, and she's really figured it out.
As much as Cole and her administrators compliment each other, so do the Paris twins. Sometimes Ashley spells Courtney coming off the bench. Other times they're on the court together. When it came time to choose a college, there was never a plan to go their separate ways.
Off the court, it's bringing a big piece of home with you. You're comfortable. You're used to someone. You're always with them. Being roommates with them isn't that difficult because you've already done it my whole entire life.
The Sooners play Texas Tech today in Lubbock. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Norman, Oklahoma.
You're listening to Only a Game. 6 years ago tomorrow, NASCAR legend Dale Earnhardt Sr. died in a last-lap crash during the 43rd running of the Daytona 500. The NASCAR world still mourns the passing of the fabled number three, even as it celebrates his contributions to auto racing, his competitive spirit, and his accessibility. Commentator Arlinda Boyer misses Earnhardt for those reasons and for others besides.
I may be the only Buddhist who loves stock car racing. Roaring engines and silent meditation have little in common, but truth and wisdom know no boundaries, and when Dale Earnhardt died, I mourned him both as a race fan and as a Buddhist. Earnhardt ruled the Quicksilver Kingdom of NASCAR. Seven times a champion, he was called the Intimidator for his aggressive style, but I think the Intimidator achieved the Buddhist ideals of presence, compassion, and joy. On the track, there is nothing but the car and its driver. The fans are invisible, the environment a mere blur. The driver is alone with his desire, his fear, and his courage, and he must be fully present. Dale carried that presence off the track as well, able to give his full attention to a single person in a room jammed with people waiting to meet him, to let each person feel they'd made a friend. Until his death, the Intimidator image kept his compassion hidden, but our authentic self emerges in moments of crisis, and more than once he leapt out of a wrecked car to make sure a competitor was all right. For me, it was proof of his bodhicitta, the awakened heart of compassion. In one of his last interviews, Dale said, "At the end of the day, I just want everyone to be happy." Though he didn't know it, that heartfelt wish for joy, open and limitless, is the definition of bodhicitta. When he won the Daytona 500 after 20 years of trying, every team that competed against him lined up to shake his hand. It had never happened before in motorsports, and it has never happened since. He said, "I hope everyone gets the chance to feel this way just once in their lives." Again, in moments that cannot be rehearsed, we see a person's true nature, and this generosity of spirit was Dale's. More than anything, Dale Earnhardt taught me joy. Because he risked death every weekend, he loved life all the more, and he lived it fully, fearlessly, with a wide-open spirit. One teaching says, "Buddha does not always appear as a Buddha. He can appear in a brothel or a gambling house. My Buddha appeared, not in robes, but in Wranglers, with twinkling blue eyes and a passion for fast cars. My Buddha died on the final lap of the Daytona 500 on February 18, 2001. Goodbye, Dale, and thank you."
He said, "Boy, do you know how it feels to run through Cause if you Daytona bound, let me warn you, you're in for a ride.
Arlinda Boyer is a grant writer for the American Shakespeare Center in Stanton, Virginia.
Then he cried when we got to Daytona.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, sharpening skates and minds at the North American Hockey Academy. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Mr. NASCAR, the focus of the auto racing world is on Daytona, Florida. Qualifying races for tomorrow's Daytona 500 were rife with all manner of intrigue, particularly involving Jeff Gordon and his low quarter panels, whatever that means, and Michael Waltrip and a mysterious substance in the intake manifold. What the heck is going on here?
Cheating is what's going on here, and this is as endemic to NASCAR as bootlegging once was. In my capacity as Mr. NASCAR, I'm very honest about my knowledge of automobiles, which is basically limited to the phrase valet parking $15. However,
what about good setup?
However, I do know that the point of having a stock car is that they're all supposed to be the same, and pretty plainly, Michael Waltrip's and Jeff Gordon's weren't.
Actually, amid all of the hanky-panky going on, my favorite story regarding the Daytona 500 involved Kenny Wallace, who will apparently stop at nothing in his attempt to qualify.
He will finish the race on his roof. Is that what he has to do to get in? You know what? If he finishes the race on his roof, they should let him in.
I agree. Good TV. So who wins this race?
Oh, I don't have the faintest idea. I'm going to go with Tony Stewart simply because everybody else I've ever heard of has been docked 100 points or set back 19 rows or something. I think Stewart will win. I think Jeff Gordon will finish higher than people think he will. And I think Michael Waltrip will finish somewhere in the top 100 and thank his wife, his 9-year-old daughter, and his personal Lord and Savior.
Just down the road from Daytona, a new partnership was announced this week, Charlie. Is it safe to conclude that as far as the racing car team owner Jack Roush is concerned, the curse of the Bambino is buried and gone forever?
Well, how many races? I'll have to look at the NASCAR schedule. How many races do they run in October? Because then you've got problems. But I suspect that John Henry, the owner of our beloved Boston Red Sox here in Boston, who has teamed up with Jack Roush to start talking about a partnership, I think in June and July, this is going to be a formidable race team.
Charlie, yesterday the University of Illinois announced the retirement of Chief Alinowick, who's danced at home football, basketball, and volleyball games there since 1926. Are we surprised that the mighty NCAA has won this battle?
This was bound to happen. The NCAA's serious about it. The NCAA basketball tournament, from which these mascots have been banned, is the primary fundraiser for all of college sports. So, no, we are not surprised. Oh, I'm a little bit surprised he's going out with as mellow a departure as he apparently is.
I hesitate to bring up college basketball with you this week, Charlie, based on one particular Valentine's Night result.
Oh, for God's sakes. Come on. Come on.
Marquette.
One loss? And it's the third item on the show? Can't we go back to talking about quarter panels now, please? Yes, they have not been shooting well. And Dominic James, the talented, if increasingly erratic point guard, has had a really bad month. So, yes, they did lose to DePaul. They will make the tournament. DePaul, that's a big win for DePaul. They're inching towards the bubble. And can we please shut up now?
We'll move right along to the NBA All-Star Weekend. Did you know that you can watch tonight's slam dunk contest in 3D?
Do I have to wear the little cardboard glasses?
Well, you can't watch it in 3D in my house. That's
no.
All I know.
You have to watch it in 3D at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino, where they have a couple of theaters which are rigged up for 3D. Now, you and I both remember 3D movies from our childhood.
Yeah,
I want to know
if they're going to
fit the seats with that old thing, the Thriller, that used to make the seats shake at inopportune times.
Yeah, this was all at the same time as Smell-O-Vision.
That's right, which they'll be using for the actual All-Star game.
One person who will not be in Las Vegas this weekend is former All-Star guard Tim Hardaway, whose comments regarding former player John Amici got the NBA's attention.
Yeah, you come on the radio and you say you hate gay people, and then you present one of the most insincere apologies in the history of apologies. You will get disinvited to Vegas and disinvited to NBA things. However, I will guarantee you that somewhere in this great land of ours, Tim Hardaway is reckoned on some talk radio program or another to be an embattled truth teller, and he will have a career on the right-wing talking head circuit.
The Boston Celtics are probably more unhappy than most teams that there's a break in the season right now. They're on a roll, huh?
Hey, one in a row, huh? Yeah, they beat the Bucks by 20. They played very well. The interesting thing about the Celtics is that, you know, they're in this position whereby their fans are sort of half rooting, half more than half, three-quarters rooting them to lose, so they'll get an opportunity at either Kevin Durant or Greg Oden in the draft. The Celtics are young and playing very hard. They're just not beating anybody. And once they lost Paul Pierce, the season went right in the tank. The other night, they played very, very well. Paul Pierce came back. As I said, they're young and enthusiastic. They're worth spending 5 or 10 minutes on television watching. They're just not very good right now.
Reliever Mariano Rivera has one more year on his contract with the New York Yankees, and he has said this week that if he becomes a free agent, quote, the Yankees will not have an advantage in bidding for his services. With 12 years in the major leagues, how can he still think all the owners have the same amount of money?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, what he's saying basically is, I think between the lines, is that he knows he's not going to be a Yankee after this year. He's 37 years old. He's not the closer he was. He's still very good. He will still entertain offers. Somebody will pay him a lot of money. It just isn't going to be the Yankees.
And finally, Charlie, various coaches of the U.S. soccer team have been criticized for keeping players around too long. Do you suppose the head of the Japan Football Association is about to hear some of the same complaints?
Well, no, he wants Kazuyoshi Miura to play for another decade. Miura is only going to be 40 this month. He wants him to play to 50, so he will emulate an English player named Stanley Matthews, who played soccer until he's 50. As far as I'm concerned, you can play soccer till you're 80. As far as I'm concerned, you can play soccer on the moon. But I certainly hope that when Miura gets to be 50, he doesn't go to 51, because we really don't want Stanley Matthews' name to fall out of the record books.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
The North American Hockey Academy Hawks have won 56 of the 65 games they've played this season. The team's seniors have accepted scholarships to Boston College, the University of Vermont, Ohio State, and Colgate University, among other schools. Those are impressive accomplishments for an academy with an enrollment of only 40. But as Only a Game's Karen Given recently discovered, Naha isn't like any other school.
So this is a Spanish class. This particular teacher kind of likes, you know, the homey setting.
And Jay Morris describes himself as the team mom for the North American Hockey Academy. Quite a statement coming from a robust former cop. He's also the school headmaster and the PA announcer for home hockey games, a task he relishes. But Morris has every reason to be proud of these girls. He's the dad of a school graduate who's now playing at Providence College. In women's college hockey, the Naha girls are everywhere.
There's, I think, 78 colleges in the U.S. that offer women's ice hockey, and we've placed kids in about 50 of those schools. And we've had kids go to State University of New York at Plattsburgh, for example. We've had kids go to Colgate, Harvard. They're really a presence in the women's hockey front in terms of the colleges that they play in.
Just this year, Naha took up residence in a former Austrian inn in the ski resort town of Stowe, Vermont. The hotel rooms became dorm rooms. The restaurant became the cafeteria. Bicycle trainers were crammed into the hot tub and sauna room. And the basement was turned into a school.
So we're just gathering a lot of data here, and then we'll crunch the numbers and see if Galileo was right or if we have reinvented science. Ready?
Yeah.
One and two and three.
Naha's science lab looks like it was once a janitor's closet, but it has all the necessary equipment to teach physics, chemistry, biology, and pretty much any other high school science. Just outside the lab door, secondhand couches are positioned around a small TV and a very large chart of the periodic table. Most of the girls are only at Naha during the hockey season, from mid-October to early March. The rest of the year, they're at their regular high school, attending dances, giggling with friends, and having a pretty conventional high school experience.
Okay, well, we finished Bel Canto. I truly liked it. I liked it more the second time than the first time. And
in Naha's study hall / lounge / cafeteria, English teacher Dave Helprin sits at the head of a small table, mixing a study of the Ann Patchett novel, Bel Canto, with excitement over the evening's hockey game. Because everyone's following a different curriculum, there are 31 teachers for just 40 students. Most of Naha's classes are taught one-on-one.
This is my biggest class. I have two kids. All my other classes are one student, which means that they can, just like you're supposed to do it, like in education school they teach you, they do brainstorming for me, and we go over that, and then they'll do a draft, and we'll go over that, and then they'll do a revision, and we'll go over that, and then they'll do a final, or maybe even another revision, we'll go over that. That's a great luxury. Most teachers don't have that luxury.
If you ask any adult, academics is the number one focus at this school. But don't be fooled. Naha is all about the hockey. Hannah Westbrook came to Naha from Laramie, Wyoming. When she arrived, she met Teddy Fortin from Brunswick, Maine, and 38 other girls who shared her passion for hockey.
It was an eye-opener, like 40 girls with the same thoughts and feelings and all wanting to be here for one reason. It was awesome. It was just amazing.
I had never played with so many good girls, you know. You're usually on a team with one or two, and we travel every weekend, but we play the best teams around. We have the best schedule of any school I know of.
You're at every major tournament. You're exposed to every coach. You're exposed to national coaches. You're, like, everyone wants to come here, and they watch you play, and they're just like, I want to be at Naha.
Naha girls have a lot of advantages. They get to play 70 to 80 games a year instead of the normal 50. They have practice every day and strength training about four times a week. They even get to come to class in their pajamas and slippers. But because they're from all over the country, the Naha Hawks don't have fans.
At our major tournaments, when we have all the parents there, it's like a really big deal because like, we score and someone cheers. But I definitely miss out on that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's hard bench cheers, that's it. It's pretty funny.
I listened to this like 10 times last night.
Are you
going
to
try for your
skates
at
Colgate?
Isn't it good?
Yeah, I'm going to try my skates now.
Most Friday afternoons are spent traveling to tournaments, but since today's game is at home, the girls settle in for a rare unstructured hour playing Dance Dance Revolution on the setup in the basement. While they dance, they lace up their skates and chatter about hockey equipment. Girls hockey is still a very small sport, but that's exactly why Naha director and head coach Bill Driscoll says the school is needed. For many girls, there are no stepping stones between the local teams they've outgrown and the elite national or college teams.
We don't necessarily get the girls from the Boston or Minneapolis here because there's so many opportunities around them and so much hockey. But we will get the girls from Fairbanks and Phoenix and Dallas and Miami because there are just no other opportunities for the very talented girl to take the next step.
When he helped found the school 7 years ago, Driscoll already knew how to run a hockey program. But for academics, he partnered with a local ski academy. Eventually, Naha struck out on its own. But academics is still one of Driscoll's biggest concerns.
For the girls, there's no NHL. Their pro career is going to be in college when they may get a scholarship that's worth $250,000. And after that, it's into the real world for them. So we had to do the educational component because parents aren't going to take a chance on putting their daughter someplace in the hope that she's going to have a multi-million dollar NHL contract someday.
It's the hope for a college scholarship that brought Teal Bishop all the way from Fairbanks, Alaska to play at Naha. In the fall, Teal will go to Ohio State University on a full scholarship. It used to be almost automatic that skilled girls hockey players would go to college for free. But as the sport has grown, Teal and her teammates have found more competition for the same number of spots on college teams.
It's harder. The coaches want to feel comfortable with their players that they're getting. They want to watch them over and over again. And being in Alaska, they wouldn't have been able to do that. They would have seen me maybe once a year. And here they can see me whenever they want. We go to tournaments every weekend. And I feel like it allowed me to get the scholarship that I dreamed about.
Worries of scholarships and college applications seem far away on the half-hour bus ride to tonight's game against a club team from Chicago called the Chill. Bobby Jean and Tim Molly have come all the way from Anchorage, Alaska, to watch their daughter Candace play. This is Candace's second year at Naha, and although Bobby Jean misses her only daughter, she doesn't regret sending her to school 4,500 miles away from home.
Well, it's just a bigger peace of mind that she's not playing with the boys anymore. They get to be, you know, 15, 16 years old, and they're getting quite a bit taller and hairier and stronger than her, so at some point, it's not safe for them to play with the boys anymore.
The Mollies and the other parents pay $22,000 a year to send their daughters to Naha. It's a lot of money, but the Mollies still feel the school is a good investment.
As a parent, you're always looking for that college scholarship, but hockey up in Alaska is really expensive just to be a comp player. So, I mean, for us, it was almost the same, you know, as playing hockey, you know, up there as it is down here.
The Chicago Chill don't present much of a challenge for the Hawks. Naha scores just minutes into the game, and then again a few minutes later. As the Hawks continue to skate circles around the Chill, Joe Milan stands at the sidelines with a clipboard getting ready for the second game of the evening. He coaches the Hawks' red team, generally made up of the younger players. His daughter Hannah is a senior at Naha and will be attending Colgate in the fall. But he cautions other parents from assuming their daughters will get the same results.
You know, my daughter is one of the lucky kids. The reality is that, yeah, we get more full scholarships probably than anyone else. I mean, I you know, statistically, we're not number one, we're number two. But even there, it's not all our kids. It's, you know, in a great year like this year, we've probably got 50% of our seniors will have full scholarships.
But Milan says a college scholarship isn't the only reason parents might invest in their daughter's future in hockey.
I coached at Williams College, you know, one of the elite academic schools in the country. 85 to 90% of the Ivy League hockey players are not Ivy League students. Reality. Just like the alumni kids get some help, athletes do get some help.
On the way home from a 7-0 victory over the Chicago Chill, the Naha Hawks chat with one another, sing along to their favorite songs on the radio, and pull out their cell phones to call home and tell their families about the game. It's a scene that will repeat just 3 more times this year before most of the students return home in early March.
Can you turn it up?
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Stowe, Vermont.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Dan Easley at WMRA. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Karen Given's Hockey School Photo Gallery, learn more about 4 Days to Glory, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Bobby Jean Molly, mother of North American Hockey Academy student Candace Molly.
She doesn't particularly like not having boys around, but as far as being parents of a, we think, a pretty beautiful young teenage daughter, we don't think that that's such a bad thing.
Yeah, and when Candace returns to regular high school, she can keep the overzealous guys at bay with a quick splenectomy with her stick blade there, forehand or backhand. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at DigitalLearning.MacFound.org.